Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Nathaniel Rich, whose new novel is King Zeno. We'll also hear from Peter Marina, author of Down and Out in New Orleans, Transgressive Living in the Informal Economy. Nathaniel Rich is one of the most versatile writers at work today. He's a writer at large for the New York Times Magazine and a contributing writer for The Atlantic and the New York Review of Books, where he writes about all kinds of subjects. He's also the author of three novels, The Mare's Tongue, Against the Odds, and his most recent New Orleans set book, King Zeno. Nathaniel Rich, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you've lived in New Orleans since 2010, and you've written a lot about the city in your nonfiction and journalism. So did you feel like you had to give it a little time to write fiction?
Yeah, certainly. I never anticipated writing fiction about New Orleans. And if you had asked me, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, I would have said, you know, not on your life would I go near it. And I have a, you know, huge amount of respect for the literary tradition here, and also just for the lived experience of the city. And so it seemed like a lot to take on. But I think, as a number of other writers have experienced living here, at a certain point, you don't have a choice and it grabs you. And I felt that way with this story.
Now, this is an historical novel, and it goes back to a really pivotal year, 1918. A lot is going on in New Orleans in that year, and you bring it all together. So tell us about that initial conception.
So the idea came from a confluence of a million sources, I suppose, like any novel, but really in particular, two things. My fascination with the Industrial Canal and the story of how it was built or dug, excavated, and I was drawn to it as a symbol of the city's troubled relationship with the natural world, and this sense of a need to control nature, often in dramatic, ambitious, earth-moving ways that ultimately, as in the case of the Industrial Canal, carry within them a seed of doom and destruction. And it seems part of the cycle of the city that it's there's an inevitability about taking on these efforts to transform nature, because we live in a place that's so inhospitable in many ways to a lived environment, to a place where human beings should live. And yet it's also essential that the city is here. And so the canal seemed a symbol of that. And as I read about it and about its history, it just fascinated me further. And especially this idea of, as they were digging up the canal, they were unearthing these various levels of ancient forests beneath the surface. So that fascinated me. And then I also became interested in the story of the Axeman. And I was reading a bunch of old newspaper articles about that case and this unsolved series of axe murders. And as I was reading about it, I discovered that at the same time there was this other parallel crime spree going on in the city about a highwayman, which is the term for somebody who is basically a stick-up artist. And he was a young African-American boy, really, 18 or 19, was holding up a bunch of folks, mainly white men, and it caused a kind of racial panic to ensue in the city. And there are all these horrible reprisal killings of innocent black people. And so reading about that, I learned that the culmination of that story was that the highwayman was said to have shot a detective named Theodore Obitz. And Obitz was, in fact, the lead detective on the Axeman. So those things all came together with the canal which is the same year, and the influenza and the end of the war and the end of Storyville. And I felt at a certain point that there was too much there not to write about.
And jazz, too.
And of course, the birth of jazz, popularization of jazz, mm-hmm. crossing over from a form that, at least in sort of New Orleans high society, was seen as this disgraceful, you know, music that gave the city a bad name. And then it crossed over around that period. And, you know, Louis Armstrong was about 18 at the time. And so there's a lot there, and it's certainly a lot to take on, but I just fell in love with all of it and saw a narrative forming out of these various strands. And as I said, at a certain point, I couldn't not do it. It was too fun.
So how do you see the city now? I mean, it's like when you drive around the part of town where this novel is set, do you see it in a different way? Are you looking at it through that lens of all that research and those pictures from the past? Because I am, I tell you, it's an amazing accomplishment.
Well, thank you. I mean, one of the wonderful things about New Orleans is that it's not all that different. I mean, there are a couple, you know, there is one scene set along the Carondelet Canal, which is no longer there. And, mm-hmm. and of course, there are many of, you know, buildings and locations that are different, especially some downtown and so on. But, you know, you can go to a lot of these, the locations in the novel, and the buildings are still there.
Yeah.
You know, the cobblestone is still there, and the sense of this city's history is very vivid in a way that it's not in so many American cities. And that's one of the things I love about New Orleans, and that in some ways made it easier for me to go back and inhabit this period.
Mm-hmm. It's a very dense novel in terms of the physical nature of the city. I mean, you describe the houses and back alleys and darkness so well, but the land itself, you know, the mud in that canal. I mean, we wallow in that mud for quite some time, but it's very satisfying at the same time. And just the sheer weight of even people. They're always big men falling on top of other big men, and you think, get me out of here.
Well, I mean, one thing that was extremely valuable to me is, you know, this is 1918 did feel to me like this pivotal moment in the city's history, as you said. But it was really difficult to find histories that treated this period. There, you know, there's a number of books about Storyville, which is right mm-hmm. before, and there's some books, there are plenty of books once you get into the 30s, but really 1918, there's very little. And so I which was in the end fortuitous, because it forced me to rely heavily on primary source material, so newspapers, but also this incredible, I found this incredible archive of recordings, of this oral history project that was done by the Friends of the Cabildo Historical Society. And they recorded about, I want to say, about 200 interviews with folks from the 70s into the 90s, roughly. And they're all collected at the central branch of the New Orleans Public Library, and there's some at Tulane in the Louisiana collection. And they're all recorded on audio cassettes,
mm-hmm.
and they're not very well indexed. It's one of my hopes that out of the publication of this book, I can somehow convince somebody to transcribe all of them. There's only transcriptions of about 10 of them, but there's an index card for each recording, and it has a description of the person and their birth date. So I went through those 200 index cards, and I found people who had been, say, sentient at the period uh-huh. in which I was, during the period in which I was writing about, and that narrowed it down to about 20 or so folks. And the interviews were conducted wonderfully. They're incredible to listen to, wonderfully, especially from my perspective, because the interviewers asked these questions that no formal histories would really even answer, like, Who, what were the songs of the street vendors? Uh-huh. You know, where did you go to the bathroom? In the house or was there an outhouse?
Ah.
Where did you buy your groceries? You know, how did mm-hmm. how did you get food? How did you, you know, what was your experience of the Mississippi River? Things like that. And so an incredible amount of really visceral and sort of sensual details derived from those interviews. And so that helped a great deal, and also just reading the newspapers at the time gave me a kind of the voice of the moment.
Such a resource, incredible. So one of the other things I admire about this book is that it's such a language-drenched novel. It's very poetic, and you write about music so exquisitely. And I wanted to ask you if you'd read a section when one of the performers, Izzy, one of the main characters, King Zeno, the title character, is playing for an appreciative audience.
I'd be happy to. Isidore pressed the cornet to his lips, and the old chemical combustion, oxygen plus metal times flesh, blew everything else out of his head. He'd heard other players describe performing as a jubilant mindlessness, a physical sensation as ecstatic as sexual euphoria, but that wasn't quite right. He used his mind, too, running through scales the way Mr. Davis at the waif's home had taught him, calculating fourths and fifths, adding crooks, slurs, and drags, scanning ahead four bars in anticipation, posing, and within milliseconds, resolving questions of harmonic density, chordal patterning, and understructure, all of which was a way of saying he was playing what he thought would sound good. But good was an understatement. It was east and west, top and bottom, in and out, all at the same time. It was chaos and freedom. So even as part of his mind was occupied with time signatures, this other, greater part of him reached beyond time. Wasn't that the very definition of immortality? What use, then, did he have for the Roosevelt Hotel when he had everything he desired right here on this old choir before an audience that was camel walking and kangaroo dipping and chicken scratching like maniacs? The red tea kettle overflowed and people began to line their coins in pious rows along the lip of the stage. The other fellows felt it too. From the moment drag started pulling on the bass, he hadn't coughed once, and Sore Dick hadn't scowled. You could hear his elation in his attack, the keys babbling like a brook before cascading in a waterfall of notes, splashing the crowd. Yes, Dick was downright giddy. Even Zitty grinned like an oyster, but maybe that was just the promise of $15.25 working on him and all the sweet stuff it could buy. Dick tapered, his cascade dwindling to a ripple, and finally eddied back into the melody. The chorus rose around them, and the crowd joined along. Make me a pallet on the floor.
You could write about 1919, and I would follow you. It would be great. It's literally, I could not put this book down. I could not bear to be separated from it. Fantastic. We've been talking with Nathaniel Rich, whose wonderful new novel is King Zeno. You can meet him Tuesday, January 9th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Nathaniel, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me on. It was a treat.
Marina is a New Orleans native who's now an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse. He spent 10 weeks back in New Orleans doing the research for his new book, Down and Out in New Orleans, Transgressive Living in the Informal Economy. And he learned a lot about his native city. Peter Marina, welcome to The Reading Life.
Pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit about writing in the wake of George Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London, and a little bit about what transgressive living is and what the informal economy is.
Sure. Well, the idea of this book came from George Orwell when he was living down and out in 1920s Paris. And while other literary figures at the time were writing about bourgeois Paris in 1929, here's Orwell working as like a plongeur, you know, in the underground parts of Paris, you know, beneath the veneer of bourgeois society. And so, just like in 1929 Paris, there's this whole underground part of New Orleans, the less discovered part of New Orleans. And to me, that was very inspiring and something to write about. It also comes from a series that we were doing with Columbia University Press on transgressive sociology. And when we talk about transgression, we distinguish it from deviancy. Transgression is more about deviancy with intent, transcendental deviancy, purposely being subversive, defying orthodoxy. And I think New Orleans, in very many ways, is part of that. It's a transgressive culture with many different transgressive subcultures that deny the humdrum mainstream world of everyday life. And I was part of that world growing up, and it continues to fascinate me today.
Oh. So you had some really interesting jobs during the course of this book. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about some of them.
When I first came down to New Orleans to do the study, I had to reproduce as closely as possible the same economic conditions as George Orwell. And as a matter of fact, I had a professor, an economist, act as my financial policeman to make sure that I was following as closely as possible the spirit of George Orwell. And so we were comparing prices of 1929 Paris to prices of New Orleans today. So Orwell had about about the equivalent of $120 or so in his pocket when he first became down and out. Although he had the first month of his rent paid for, so I had the first month of my rent paid for as well. But when I landed in New Orleans, I had that, you know, $120. I had a pocket knife with me. I had a video recorder, just a couple of other things, the clothes on my back, another pair of pants and a shirt, you know, not too much more. And I had a resume that I made up, and it didn't say much about me except for that I had some jobs in New Orleans, some bartending jobs. I kind of fibbed a little bit on that resume. Said I graduated from the University of New Orleans, and that was it. So I'm taking it to the streets, walking down Bourbon Street, going into different places trying to find a job, and eventually I got hired at Café Beignet on Bourbon Street. And so that was one of my main jobs. But I would do other things as well as I came across all of these, you know, different transgressive lives and all these creative people. I started hanging around with them and doing the things that they did, which is part of what ethnography is about, kind of becoming part of the world of others. And so I would befriend people like Eric Auditorium, and he taught me how to stomp on glass. So I would go to what he calls a sideshow freak show south, and we would perform in different venues, you know, at these kind of freak clown shows. And so I would stomp on glass with him as Cuban Pete the Clown. I would write poetry for tourists on Frenchman Street. I worked out a deal where I would help out with Airbnbs and kind of work as a cleaner in some of these places so I could get cheaper rent to stay, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so it was pretty cool.
What was the hardest thing for you to do?
I thought that it would be to sleep in a vacant house in New Orleans. That was something new to me, just trying to scope out how to find a vacant house to sleep in that's safe, to make sure you don't get caught by the police, to make sure in the middle of the night somebody doesn't come and, you know, do something horrible to you. I thought that would be the hardest thing, but actually it was going to the homeless shelter that was probably the most difficult. And I would wonder, and I would think in my head, you know, here's a homeless shelter, right? And there's a Claiborne, I think it's the Claiborne overpass, not far away. And you have all these people sleeping, you know, in these kind of tent cities underneath the overpass. Like, why on earth don't they go into the homeless shelter? And I would go into the homeless shelter, and, you know, much like George Orwell experienced, you know, somebody has a few more dollars in their pocket and, you know, you didn't prove your worth in some capitalist labor market, people feel the right to preach over you.
Right.
And walking into that homeless shelter, that same thing happened where, because I was perceived as poor and homeless, that, you know, people feel the right that they can preach on you, that you live, you know, that you don't live well because you're poor, that something is wrong with you because you're poor, that you are a degenerate and you need to improve yourself simply because you're poor. And feeling that, it kind of gave me that sense of social injustice that, you know, that people that are down and out must feel all the time.
And your writing brings out that sense of claustrophobia you feel when you're locked in for the night. You know, that's a really incredible feeling.
Oh, sure. It's in many ways, it felt like being in jail. Mm-hmm. And it was the same thing. And that's why I end like, yeah, I'd rather sleep underneath the overpass any day.
And you give this whole guide to how to find the best place to squat, which is deeply practical. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
Everything from no cracks in the floor, be careful how many neighbors you have, be close to tourist areas. It was just fascinating. Now, you give us a sense of the difficulties of life as a street performer. And one character, one person, captivated me particularly, and that was Shannon, the whip girl on Bourbon Street, and her desire to be a poet, her desire to be a performer. Talk a little bit about her.
Sure. Shannon has this dual dimensions of her life. She's in many ways a transient. She has the soul of Jack Kerouac, always trying to find, you know, the next it, the place to be among the Fahaleen people of the world. And so she's a traveler, a drifter, but also has a sense of home kind of anywhere she goes. So she loves writing poetry. She loves being able to become a self-street entrepreneur.
I love that you included some of the poems. I thought that was important.
Well, absolutely. It takes an amazing amount of talent. You know, I mean, you know, when I'm a university professor, and so a lot of times my students complain that they don't have what's called, it's a word that I really don't like, a rubric, which details everything they need to do for every specific assignment. And here's Shannon, no real formal education, who is able to make pretty good money just sitting there with a typewriter, and someone will... you know, tourists will come up to her and say, "Hey, write me a poem about absinthe or about love or about whatever," right? And she'll just got it and just start writing immediately. And she'll come out with this beautiful poem. And I would sit there and I would look at her typing the poem, and she had it called Poetry While You Wait.
Right.
And so the tourists would wait there, and then she would finish the poem in about 5 minutes, you know, tear it out, read it back to the person. And they were always impressed. They were always impressed. And you know, she would get like $20 every time. I'm like, not bad. If you do 5-6 poems in one evening on Frenchman Street, you're not doing bad.
That's right. And you have a fabulous, fascinating, and hilarious experience with City Hall and our bureaucracy, just trying to become a street poet yourself. So talk a little bit about that for us.
Sure. And, you know, the people of City Hall and the bureaucracy, they're just trying to do the best job that they can do. But talk about dysfunction, right? I mean, you walk in and you're like, okay, how do I get a license to do poetry, for example? And so you would figure you need some type of license. So I was figuring that maybe, you know, if you go to City Hall, you can find out how to get a license to do poetry. And what inspired this was that while I was doing Down and Out and I was hanging out with Shannon, the police had told her she'd need to move out of her spot or get arrested or get a ticket. And she was so upset that why are they kicking me out of here? What am I doing wrong? I'm not blocking the sidewalk. I'm not doing anything that should you know, be considered illegal. Yet, I guess it was sometimes up to a police officer's discretion, she was asked to move out. So I was like, well, what could someone like Shannon do in order to have the right to you know, busk poetry on Frenchman Street? And there's other buskers as well doing this on Frenchman Street. So I said, well, let me go to City Hall and try to figure out how to do this. And so I would go to one part of City Hall and they'd say, no, you need to go to this division over here. And so I'd go to this division over there and talk to people. And they'd say, no, you need to go to the 7th floor. So I'd go up to the 7th floor and then I would wait in line and, you know, I would try to figure out, well, who am I supposed to talk to here? And that a bunch of different kind of divisions in that 7th floor. But eventually I was able to talk to someone. And you know, it was interesting that the person was trying genuinely to answer my question and flipping through files and going on the internet and looking on a computer and flipping through more files. And I'm asking more questions. And eventually she was like, maybe you should just not worry about this and bust poetry. When the police come, you know, keep a low profile.
And then you talk to the police themselves.
Absolutely. I went back to the Vucre, the 8th District Police Station, which brought a sense of nostalgia for me because my father was a police officer there and he was one of the commanders in the Vucre District. And I remember going there after high school at De La Salle, taking a streetcar down and hanging out with my father a little bit. And so here I am now as a sociologist trying to figure out what's going on. And basically the police said, if you want to go bust poetry, we got bigger fish to fry than you, buddy, right? So go ahead and busk if you want to. The only problem is, I suppose, there's some times where the poets are asked to move. So they'll move, they'll go away, and then a few days later they can come back, and usually there's no problem for at least a while.
Right. Oh, that's reassuring. Well, I get the sense that what you want most from this book is for us to see these people, to see their lives in all their clarity and murkiness, you know, and to see them as contributors to our city, as part of the great culture that is New Orleans. That seems to me to be your point in this book.
Yeah, I believe so. And New Orleans is filled with colorful characters, and it's these people that live these transgressive lifestyles on the social urban fringes of New Orleans that make this city what it is, and they have always made this city what it is. And it's alive and well. And although the capitalist logic of accumulation reifies and destroys everything in its path, They still are here on the urban fringes. They're still carving out a living. They're still finding creative cultural solutions to their collectively experienced structural problems. They're still trying to find a way to make it. And I think that that resiliency breeds this creativity, and it bursts all over the place in New Orleans. And that's what makes New Orleans a highly unique place.
And it's such a muse for you. Your writing is so beautiful. And I get the sense that you saw New Orleans in a new way.
When you're an academic, a lot of us have this tendency to write in this cold, dry, sterile way where we take the color out of people. We take their personality away. We tend to reduce them to variables and numbers. I didn't want to do that. You can't do that. Not when you're writing about New Orleans. And so I wanted their voice to come out. I wanted their personalities to come out. I wanted their souls to come out. And so I decided to write the book in a way that lacks that academic jargon, but instead to let the characters emerge and let them tell their story, and me kind of narrating it, obviously, as the author, but having them come out and present themselves fully to spread their wings was the most important thing.
We've been talking with Peter Marina, whose new book is Down and Out in New Orleans, Transgressive Living in the Informal Economy. You can meet him Thursday, January 11th at 6 at Octavia Books. Peter, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Nathaniel Rich, discusses his new novel, King Zeno, with Katie Simpson Smith, Tuesday, January 9th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Amy Stewart discusses her new crime novel, Miss Copp's Midnight Confessions, Tuesday, January 9th at 6 at Octavia Books. Francine Klagsbrun discusses her book, Lioness, Golda Meir and the Nation of Israel, Tuesday, January 9th at 7 at the Uptown Jewish Community Center. Dwayne Huff discusses in Science Write Your Own Ticket, Turn Your Passion into Your Profession, Tuesday, January 9th at 7 at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Peter Marina, discusses in Science Down and Out in New Orleans, Transgressive Living in the Informal Economy, Thursday, January 11th at 6 at Octavia Books. Linda Thurman discusses in Science A Brief History of Hollywood South, Thursday, January 11th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Martha B. Boone discusses in Science her novel The Big Free, Friday, January 12th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Women's National Book Association of New Orleans celebrates National Reading Group Month with a panel of poets Saturday, January 13th at the Mid-City Library. Featured poets include Stacey Balkin, Gina Ferrara, Carolyn Hembry, former State Poet Laureate Julie Kane, and Andrea Panzica. The event begins with a meet and greet at 11:30, a Share Your Book Group Experience discussion at noon, followed by a panel discussion at 12:30, then a reception. Jessica Schecksnyder and Mary B. Mannheim discuss and sign Fragile Grounds, Louisiana's Endangered Cemeteries, Tuesday, January 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. Tyler Bridges discusses and signs Long Shot, Thursday, January 18th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Fun with Big Fat Books reading group starts its spring season with As I Lay Dying, beginning January 23rd for 3 weeks, following that up with The Sound and the Fury beginning February 19th. Email Abita Blaylock, that's ABITABLAYLOCK, at gmail.com for information and fees. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.